We are looking at the Bible's big story. And we'll find ourselves here in Exodus, where last Sunday we saw the people who had been in prison set free. The God who is leading them to a particular destination. In the Bible storybook it says, "I will bring you to a new home, a special land," God promised them, "and I will look after you. I am with you." And the big surprise was the way that God led them and where God led them. God didn't take them by the shortest route. He actually took them by the longest route. And then he leads them into a cul-de-sac. A sea in front of them, a desert on one side, jagged rocks on the other, and a powerful enemy behind them who wants them back. All the way through our lives, we are told that God wants you back. He is not the only one who wants you back. There is an enemy who wants you back. And behind them, they have this powerful Egyptian enemy who wants them back, who regret what they have done. But God has a purpose bringing them into this cul-de-sac, a purpose for Pharaoh, a purpose for his people. And this is the controlling truth that shapes the whole story. It says this in chapter 14 in verse 4. It says, "And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and his host, and Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord." And they did so. And there in the cul-de-sac, a leader steps up. "Fear not, stand firm, and see the salvation of the Lord." And what we discover here is that they look in the front of them, they look to the side of them, and they look to the behind to them. There seems to be nowhere to look. And Moses says there is always a place to look. Look up. Look to the God who holds you and loves you. There is only one way to look. Let me ask you, where are you looking for rescue? If you're looking within, or if you're looking to change in circumstance, it's not going to save you. There is only one way to look for rescue. And God makes a way. And the people are not only set free, they discover that they are no longer a slave. And the ones that who once oppressed them are gone. And as they cross to the other side, they've got a new song to sing. And it's a song with God at the center. The song, "No Longer a Slave," but I think it's by Shane, and Shane says this: "You split the sea so that I could walk right through it. My fears are drowned in perfect love. You rescued me so that I could stand and say, I am a child of God. I'm no longer a slave to fear. I am a child of God. I am no longer a slave to fear. I am a child of God." And here's the big picture that the Bible storybook helps us with. It says, from the beginning, God's children had been running from him and hiding. God knew that his children could never be happy without him. They couldn't get back to him by themselves. They were lost. They didn't know the way back to God. But God knew the way. And one day, he would show them. Now, I imagine that if you set out this week to read from Exodus chapter 16 to 40, I would imagine, and I'm not being unkind, that some started and didn't finish. Or some didn't start at all and just went, "Oh, I'm not doing that." Or some got to the end of it in 16 to 40 and you went, "Oh, my head's fried. I have no idea what that is about." And so what we're going to do this morning is that we're going to have three stops in this big section in Exodus. We're going to start with the chapter that we read, chapter 16, blessings and grumbling. We're then going to look at some verses in chapter 20 under the heading of 10 ways to be perfect. And then lastly, in chapter 33, a little glimpse of heaven. Blessing and grumbling, 10 ways to be perfect, and a little glimpse of heaven. And so chapter 16 begins with background noise. Are you familiar with that expression? It says, there's a background noise in my life. There's a background noise at workplace. There's a background noise in my life. And here we discover that the background noise in the whole of the story of Exodus from chapter 16 all the way to the end of chapter 40 is grumbling and complaining. where the big issue has moved from the hardness of the heart of Pharaoh to the unbelief in the heart of God's people. And in chapter 16, what we discover are two things. That first of all, the heart of God's people are revealed in the opening three verses, and they are discovered that they are a discontented people. And the verses open, but they really say this: God, we wish you hadn't bothered to rescue us. And there they are in this difficult circumstance, and the first thing that they do is question what caused the suffering. And the second thing that they do is that they question God's intention. Now ask yourself, where does grumbling and complaining come from? Grumbling and complaining comes from being centered on self. And that God is not God, but he is your divine butler who is there to serve your every need. Grumbling comes from the place that you are the center of the universe and God is your servant. And we discover that this problem of grumbling is not a new one and it doesn't go away. Because not only is this the refrain throughout the whole of the book of Exodus, it is also the refrain throughout the New Testament. It's those verses that evangelical Christians skip over and see not as important as others. Listen to what it says in Philippians chapter 2 and verse 14. It says, "Do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may be blameless and innocent children of God without..." And isn't there that bit in us, "But I can't help it"? No, listen to what it says. "Do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may be blameless and innocent children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation among whom you shine as lights in the world." And you catch that glimpse that what is to make church distinctive from the world? What is to make the Christian distinctive in the workplace? What is to make the Christian distinctive in a family where you might be the only believer is that you are not a moany face. That the Christian is actually known as someone who shines as light. If you go online just now, what is the overarching feeling? Complaining and moaning and crumbling. Listen to what it says in James chapter 5 and verse 9. It says, "Do not grumble against one another, brothers and sisters, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door." And the illustration is like this. Imagine the teacher has stepped out the classroom and it all kicks off and the teacher appears at the doorway. Well, the picture of that is a church that are all moaning and complaining at one another, and Jesus himself appears at the doorway and goes, "This is how I taught you to love." And so the background noise of the whole of the book of Exodus is one of grumbling and complaining. Why? Because they believed the lie. Do you remember how we began the Bible's big storybook? It said this: "God doesn't want us to be happy," they said. It was the same lie that Adam and Eve heard in the garden. It was the first lie: "God doesn't want you to be happy." And so just as the heart of a discontented people are revealed, we discover in chapter 16 in verse 4 that the heart of God is revealed. Look at what it says in chapter 16 in verse 4. It says, and this is the response. "Those of you who have had small children and have all had a day complaining at one another, is this how you respond to their grumbling?" Look at what it says in verse 4. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Behold, I am about to rain bread from heaven for you. And the people should go out and gather a day's portion every day.'" What extraordinary grace, undeserved, before they had turned to seek him. And here you have the challenge of grace, because grace itself is a challenge, because verse 4 continues like this. It says, "That I may test them." Have you ever wondered, have you ever realized that the blessings of God and the challenges of God can both be a challenge? "That I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not." Because what is it that God looks for? What is a defining relationship that he wants with you? What is that character that he wants to see in you? What else does he want from you? Think of the answer in your head. He wants your obedience. He wants you to trust him. When does he want you to trust him? He wants you to trust him when you've got plenty and there's manna from heaven. And he wants you to trust him when you've got nothing. And for some, it's the challenge to trust God when we have plenty because we think we are the self-made man or woman. And for some, it's the ability to trust God when we have nothing. But the purpose of grace is always the same. It is that we know that he is the Lord. What does trust really look like? Well, here in Exodus, we've got to discover that trust is that what God provides us is enough. What do we pray in the Lord's Prayer? Matthew 6 and verse 11. Give us this day our daily bread. Listen to it says in Matthew 6 and verse 34, in the Sermon on the Mount, that in some ways that equivalent of picture of what it means to live in the kingdom, it says this, therefore do not be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious for itself. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. I'm not sure I live like that. And in that, I'm saying to God, I do not trust you to deal with my past, and I do not trust you to deal with tomorrow. What does disobedience look like? Disobedience is coming to God and say, I know better. And all the way through this chapter, when the people decide that they know better than God, what do they end up with? Maggots. When you look at your life and you make choices for your life that you know are in contradiction with what God has commanded, do you know what you will end up with? Maggots. It'll be sweet in the tongue and bitter in the stomach. And whether it's the simplicity of picking up manna from heaven or what we do with our lives, it is always the same. Disobedience is saying to God, I know better than you. I know that's what your word says, but God, you don't have a clue. It is treating God like a fool. And the challenge here in Exodus 16 is to live a life in response to grace because there is a God to know. A God that you can trust. Because even in the glimpse of manna from heaven, we get a picture of the fact that someone greater is coming. And it's not the pot of manna that rescues you. It's the one that it points to. But then when you jump to chapter 20, so there's chapter 16, our first stop, grumbling and complaining. When we jump to chapter 20, we discover that there are 10 perfect rules to live by. And here's how it starts, and it's important to see how it starts because it's the only way that the rest makes any sense. Look at what it says in chapter 20 in verse 1. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. And in that opening verse, before you get to the commandments, you get the two themes that we have been looking at combined. First of all, revelation, I am the Lord, rescue, who brought you out. And the order of it matters. The timing of it matters. It is not that while they were in Egypt, God said, if you obey these 10 commandments, then I will rescue you. And only when you obey these commandments will I save you. What we discover is that God sets them free so that they can keep these commandments. And even though these are creation ordinances, they are written into our DNA. It wasn't keeping them that was going to set them free. They were set free so that they might be able to keep them. And in keeping them, here's the point, in keeping them, they knew and discovered what it was to be free. In the Garden of Eden, the devil offered sin and temptation and said, this is the only way you can be truly free. The opposite happens. It leads you into slavery. It holds you captive. Grace sets him free. And what is so beautiful here is the compassion of God that having set this people free, leading them to the promised land, he knows our hearts. Some of you who are older, did you ever think that we would be in a place, before David Steele ever brought his abortion document, that we would be in a place that in the civilized West, we would allow abortions at full term? Did you ever believe that we could? And just now, through both parliaments, are coming assisted dying, and we're saying it's going to be so lovely, it's going to be so beautiful, it's going to be so keen. Do you think for a moment that's how it's going to be? God knows our hearts. He knows what sin can do. He knows how we are tempted. He knows that we have got seared consciences, and he then opens his word and says, you shall love me with all your heart. Here's a new way to live. Here's the law of perfect freedom. Let me ask you, as you read through these, flick through the Ten Commandments, all right? Which one no longer matters? Anyone? Is there anyone here that we now know better? But what we discover is that each one of them is the law of perfect freedom. It is a new way to live. 10 perfect rules to live by. And when we come to the commandments, Ray Ortland's get this really helpful thing. He says there are 4 things to remember when we look at the commandments of God. The first thing is revelation. The commandments are an insight into the character of God. You get a glimpse of what matters to God. For example, what kind of amazing person would say to us, you shall not steal? Only a just and a generous person who can be fully trusted, who would never rob us or defraud us, who would never lie or cheat, who would never hold out on us wrongly, who is not out for himself, who feels no need but overflowing kindness. The commandments tell us something about God. But what they also do is that they are a confrontation. They are an insight into our own character. Have you ever looked at some of these bottles that you get, and there's a sign on it says, like, this is poisonous, do not drink. And you go, what kind of people need a sign that says don't drink? And have you ever seen those signs, and you've seen these kind of safety warnings, and you went, how stupid are we to need these? Maybe I'm the only one that's very judgmental. But you do, don't you? You look at it and go, oh my word, it's a special kind of stupid. What kind of people need to be told do not steal? Do not commit adultery. Do not murder. What does it say about the propensity of the human heart? That these are our temptations. And so it confronts us with who we are, what's inside of here. And so there's revelation, there's confrontation, but there's also instruction. Here is a new way to walk. The catechism, the larger catechism actually says here that with every sin that is forbidden, the contrary is commanded. You shall have no other God before me. You shall love me with all my heart, your heart. Revelation and confrontation, instruction, and lastly, promise. Listen to what it says, and it's picked up tonight in Hebrews. It says, for this is the, and from Jeremiah 31 and 34 says, for this is a covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them, and I will write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. When you become a Christian, God changes your heart. So the things that were once sweet to you become sour, and the things that were once sour to you become sweet. But why does it matter? Because at its heart is relationship. Jesus says in John 14, verse 15, if you love me, you will feel fuzzy. If you love me, you will sing songs with great enthusiasm. Jesus says, if you love me, you will obey what I command. Jesus says in John 14 and verse 21, whoever has my commands and obeys them, he is the one who loves me. You cannot live a life in contradiction with what Jesus commands and claim that you love him. John 14 and verse 23 says, Jesus replied, if anyone loves me, he will obey my teaching. My Father will love him, and he will come to him and make our home with him. He who does not love me will not obey my teaching. Mark chapter 12 and verse 29 says, Jesus answered, the most important is this, hear, O Israel, love the Lord your God. The Lord your God is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. And my problem is I have not loved God with all my heart, with all my soul and all my strength and all my mind. And this is what it exposes. When the law is introduced, when the commandments come, it actually exposes that we fall short. The parable of the Good Samaritan is great, isn't it? It tells you, be like the Good Samaritan. No, it doesn't. It's got nothing to do with that. The parable of the Good Samaritan is in a context where people are confident of their own righteousness, and Jesus introduces and tells this parable and says, love like this, to expose our moral and spiritual bankruptcy. Jesus doesn't say, go and do likewise. He says, you cannot love like this. Hebrews chapter 7 and verse 19, verses we looked at last Sunday night, said, for the law made nothing perfect. And you've got this whole section that runs from 16 all the way through to chapter 40. This whole section to do with the ceremonial law, this whole section to do with the priesthood. And you think, what's that got anything to do with me? It's got everything to do with you, because how do you get to draw near to God? The one relationship that you were made for, how do you get to draw near to him? Well, you need to read chapter 16 all the way to chapter 40, and then you need to read Hebrews 8. But here's the point. You've got all this ceremonial law. You've got all these priests one after another, but they would never save you. Being a better person never gets you to glory. Pulling yourself up by the socks never gets you to heaven. But it was never intended to. It was always pointing to someone greater. And when you get to chapter 33, you catch a glimpse of the purpose of it all. You catch a glimpse of heaven. And here in Exodus 25, it lets us understand what is happening. Listen to what it says, Exodus 25 and verse 8. And let them make me a sanctuary, that I may dwell in their midst. Exactly as I show you concerning the pattern and tabernacle of all its furniture, so you shall make it. So do you see the purpose of it all? So that God would be among us. And in chapter 33, you discover that Moses refuses something that some of us are content with. Let me say that again. Moses refuses something that some of us are content with. They want the blessing of God, but not his presence. Moses refuses the blessing of God unless he has the presence of God. And he comes to God in chapter 33 and says, God, without you, none of it matters. And the heart of Moses is revealed in chapter 33, where he comes and says, God, it's you that I want. It's you that makes us different. It's your presence that we need. And we're given a glimpse of heaven. 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 5 says this, "For we, what we proclaim is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, with ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For God, who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,' has shone in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ." But it not only gives you a glimpse of heaven, it gives you a glimpse of the Christmas story, where people want its blessings, but not his presence. We want the sentimentality, but not the reality. The Christmas story is God's revelation. How is Jesus called in Matthew? Emmanuel, which means, "I am with you." What have we just read in Exodus chapter 25? "I am with you." And here comes God's rescuer. But here is what makes him different, is that he is perfect in every way. He did what others could not do. Every commandment he kept. But here is what is so beautiful. He says, "I am with you." What does the name Jesus mean? Anyone? What does the name Jesus mean? I can't hear you, Catherine. It means God saves. Emmanuel, I am with you. Jesus, God saves. Listen to what the Bible storybook says. Only one person could keep all the rules. And many years later, God would send him to stand in their place and be perfect for them, because rules couldn't save them. Only God can. God, says Moses, if I don't have you, what's the point? I've got nothing. If I don't have your presence, the rules only mock me. With God, with Christ, everything changes. And yet there is that bit in us that says, he doesn't want me to be happy. Can I use a vernacular? Shut up. Look at what he's done. He has come down. He has reached out to those who could not reach up to him. He came perfect in every way and paid the price. He doesn't want you to be happy. That's the biggest lie. He offers not just blessing. He offers his presence. And with him, everything changes. Everything. Let's pray together.